Welcome back to The Far Middle and episode 53, and a happy Memorial Day. Always a fun day, Memorial Day with friends and family. Got that long weekend, but let's never forget what it's truly about. That, of course, is to remember those who served and paid the ultimate price for preserving our republic. I guess when it's all said and done, freedom ain't free. Now, I'm sorry to see May fading, as we're at the end of the month here, but it was an awesome month. And of course, as May fades, here comes summer, here comes June. Schools are out, the pools are opened up, flowers are in bloom, and the days are getting so much better utilized now that we can do things outside. So it's good to be alive, and I hope that you are also doing well. Dedication for episode 53. It's going to go to one of the top five most intimidating pitchers of all time. So if you remember back a few episodes, we dedicated episode 45 to Bob Gibson, who I considered to be the most intimidating pitcher in the history of baseball. He fundamentally changed the game and the rules. But there was another guy, another righty, who pitched when Gibson was in his prime that gave him a run for his money in the intimidation department. And his name was Don Drysdale, and he did his thing with the Los Angeles Dodgers, and in fact started out doing his thing with the Dodgers when they were still in Brooklyn. Now, two things made Drysdale an intimidator. First was his size. He was 6'5", and he got to stand on top of an elevated mound. The second thing was his willingness, and really wasn't so much willingness, it was his eagerness to pitch inside and tight. He loved to brush back batters or worse. And that approach that he used, it worked. Orlando Cepeda, another Hall of Famer, great hitter, he described Drysdale. He said, the trick against Don Drysdale is to hit him before he hits you. Drysdale's 154 batters hit by a pitch were a modern National League record. And as he put it, my own little rule was 2-for-1. If one of my teammates got knocked down, then I knocked down two on the other team. So I guess he was sort of an Old Testament type of guy, or Old Testament times two. It wasn't just an eye for an eye. It was two eyes for an eye. In 1962, he won the Cy Young, had an outstanding season, tallied 25 wins. In 1963, he notched over 250 strikeouts. And in 1965, he had 23 wins. And amazingly, he hit 7 home runs in 65. And another odd thing and trait about Drysdale is what I just mentioned. He was a good hitter for a pitcher, and he even pinch hit in a World Series game. In one season, he was the only Dodger to bat 300, and that season was 1965. So think about that. The pitcher was the only member of the team that ended up batting over 300 for this season. That, again, was the 1965 Dodgers. But Drysdale's most famous feat was in 1968. And we've mentioned this in prior episodes. I think it was, again, episode 45 when we're talking about Bob Gibson. 68 was dubbed the year of the pitcher. Gibson went on an epic tear, including the ERA level that he set. Denny McClain of the Tigers won 31 games. Well, Drysdale contributed to the year of the pitcher by throwing 6 consecutive complete game shutouts. 6 consecutive complete game shutouts. And he notched 58 2/3 consecutive scoreless innings. Amazing. An off-the-field cool aspect of Drysdale lore was how he teamed up with his even more famous and even more dominant pitching rotation mate Sandy Koufax to combine their bargaining power to negotiate better contracts for themselves with the Dodgers, and this was back in the spring of 1966. So the two of them, they held out together, and both of them were rewarded with record contracts at the time. Now think about this. In 1966, you had the most dominant left-handed pitcher ever in Koufax, along with one of the best right-handers in the game with Drysdale, playing for a big market team in Los Angeles. Their reward, that record pair of contracts, were for $130,000 for Koufax and just over $100,000 for Drysdale. They became the first pitchers to earn more than $100,000 for a season in baseball history. And the Dodgers, they wouldn't grant the multi-year deals. They gave one-year deals. What would those two garner today in the market if they were professional baseball players? I think that's why there's a lot of resentment when you heard from the old timers back from the 50s and 60s when they were great stars, Hall of Famers, and how they view today's game. There's this sort of lamenting or resentment on what they could have made if they had just simply played at a different period of time. Now, Drysdale was way before my time viewing baseball, so he came before I was even aware of the game. But I remember him as a sportscaster because he went into the sports booth after he left the pitching mound. I remember him on national games I remember him with the great Vin Scully because I think they were sort of announcing tandems with the Dodgers. And also, he did a program, I believe it was called Baseball Talk. He covered, I want to say, the National League, and Joe Torre at the time was his partner that covered sort of interviews, discussions with the American League side of things. Now, he's in the Hall of Fame, rightfully so. He died too young from a heart attack. Episode 53 goes to Don Drysdale, a great when baseball was a game that went beyond fantasy and went beyond analytics and social media clips and beyond a time when, like you have today, where it's either a strikeout or a home run at every at-bat, back when it was truly a game of strategy. Let's get moving on connecting some dots. I'm going to be covering a lot of them in the next 25 minutes or so, and some of you constant listeners have been asking if I would release two Farmittles a week or every other week to keep more content and keep things more current in a world full of developments that seem to be coming fast and more furious by the day. Hey, I'd love to, but you know, I do have a day job, I've got a big family, so I thought this through. How about a compromise where we select an episode, say once a month, where we do our version of a lightning round, recovering and connecting a bunch of issues in succession. Then once that bench is cleared of topics, we can go back to maybe a smaller number of dots with a little bit deeper dive for each per episode. So episode 53, let's make it our first lightning round episode with issues coming at you fast and high and tight, just like a Don Drysdale fastball. And let's start with markets, because markets are moving faster than a fastball these days, with much of the movement in the wrong directions. Much is predicted, if I may add without sounding arrogant, in my book Precipice and in prior Far Middle podcasts. So I hope you're able to heed some of that caution and avoid much of the current market meltdown. As capital markets start to wake up and smell the coffee, that is a bleak environment for investors moving forward until at least some things change. A lot of myths are being exposed, and two myths in particular have been exposed and contrasted in a really stark manner about 2 weeks ago, I think, is when it first occurred. Because in the middle of May, we saw the largest, most valuable company title change hands. It was Apple until the smartphone maker was dethroned by Saudi Aramco, which is the Saudi Arabian oil producer. So what two myths were exposed with this changing of the global top spot when it came to most valuable company? First, the myth that tech entities have no way to go in valuation but up. That's been betrayed as a mirage. And it's not just Apple that sees stock price headwinds. Heck, Apple is actually doing quite well when you compare it to something like Netflix or Facebook or Rivian or Amazon, or of course, crypto. The second item is the myth of oil or natural gas entities being non-investable, having no future due to the illusion that the world's no longer going to need carbon. That's been completely debunked in 2022. The demand for energy, including carbon-based energy, it continues to rise across the world. Geopolitical instability due to energy insecurity, that's being created from these poorly thought-out energy and climate policies, which have created energy scarcity, they've raised energy costs, and they made the very things the policies and the elite were looking to eradicate. Instead, it made them extremely profitable. To the point, again, where a Mideast oil producer is now the most valuable company on the planet. So if you don't like that fact, and I don't, then I think you should blame an environmentalist or a bureaucrat that decided it was in our best interest to vilify and attack domestic energy like natural gas and oil. Now, I just mentioned Rivian when I was running through those tech companies as a techie darling that is no longer a darling. Let's hit that dot a little bit harder, which we also brought up the subject of Rivian, I think, in a prior Far Middle podcast a number of weeks back. Its stock IPO'd at a very high level, and then it went absolutely nuts. It kept going up. And basically, the whole reason for it was its business model, which relied almost entirely on government subsidy around electric vehicles, creating a protected market for it. So Rivian ended up with a market cap that was higher at one point than every car manufacturer in the world, except for two that were named Tesla and Toyota. It's amazing. And what did it sort of achieve or accomplish to get that valuation? It delivered a grand total of 156 vehicles before its IPO. That's it. But it couldn't produce cars at the levels it promised. And today, if you want to buy a Rivian pickup truck, an EV pickup truck made by Rivian, it's going to cost you a nice $80,000, 80. And now borrowing, of course, is not free, as the Federal Reserve has to tighten monetary policy and raise interest rates because of inflation. So all these things have combined where you look at Rivian today, it's trading at about 15% of where it was during its peak. It's pretty impressive when you have government policies that sort of accomplish three things simultaneously: fleecing taxpayers, fleecing consumers, and fleecing investors all at the same time. I think you're starting to see that with a lot of policies surrounding things like electric vehicles. And EV manufacturers, they aren't the only source of what is misleading these days, bringing us to the next dot, which is inflation and deficits. Many economists and politicians, they're trying to put lipstick on the pig that is inflation by saying that it's good because it reduces government debt ratios. So what are they talking about? How does this occur? Inflation, okay, the argument is inflation drives prices and business revenues higher, which may raise GDP in the short term. So the same amount of debt that a government holds will yield a lower debt to GDP ratio if GDP goes up in the short term, which creates the mirage of better fiscal stability for a government. That's wrong, of course, because higher inflation means higher interest rates, which will raise spending deficits as the mortgage bill for all that government debt goes up. So government has to spend more to cover its interest expense on all that debt because interest rates have gone up. And that will increase the debt levels over time. And of course, inflation eventually, it's not going to be a good thing for the private sector. It will crimp businesses and GDP over the longer term and intermediate term. And you end up with a double whammy. So watch our debt levels, watch them become more unsustainable, not less or lower, because as time goes on and inflation continues to rage, it's going to do bad things to both the numerator and the denominator when you look at debt to GDP. Debt's going to go up, GDP is going to be crimped. To argue otherwise is laughable. Yet, you know, ridiculous positions and views, they are the norm in government. Brings us to the next dot of John Kerry, aka the climate czar. A few weeks back, as natural gas prices were raging and energy security was plummeting across the United States and Europe, John Kerry said two things that got my attention as the most obscene statements in a world where currently having that crown, it takes some serious effort to achieve. So that's quite an accomplishment. First thing he did was he gave the energy industry no more than 10 years to stop providing quality of life for all. Well, that is about, I guess, 8 more years than I give John Kerry, considering we're almost halfway through the brutal Biden term. Second thing John Kerry said, and I'm going to quote from him here, no one should make it easy for the gas interest to be building out 30 or 40 year infrastructure, end quote. Nice. Stopping the private sector from building infrastructure to improve our economy and improve our strengthening of our geopolitical standing. Nope, we don't want any of that, right? We can do without that. John Kerry, or his stage name, the Climate Czar, it's like, that's sort of reminding me more and more is that magic eight ball you had as a kid, where you ask a question, you shake it up, and you see what silliness it admits. He's starting to mirror that more and more. And John Kerry, besides showing an ability to take the most ludicrous of positions at the worst possible times, also has a penchant for saying one thing and then doing another. So what I'm talking about here is you tell all of us to refrain from energy use, but then you go and fly private. Or you say it's code red if we don't act now and the coastline will be underwater in a few years, and then you drop millions and millions of dollars on waterfront mansions in New England. This type of hypocrisy of the left and the elite brings us to our next dot. And I want to talk about wealthy neighborhoods in big cities who increasingly you see them paying for private neighborhood-wide security in addition to the city police force. So this is to bolster on top of the sort of patrols and protection they get from city police forces. Chicago is a great example. Those affluent enclaves of Lincoln Park and Bucktown and Lakeside, if you're familiar with Chicago, those neighborhoods are paying up and hiring security to patrol the streets. Why are they doing this? Well, crime, of course, and the fear that comes with it. And what's the result? Well, there's some unintended consequences. First, it's going to widen economic and social disparity because the poorer neighborhoods who can't afford the extra security, they're going to be forced to suffer higher crime. And the other unintended consequence is that it also lessens the pressure to take better stances on crime, since these influential, well-to-do constituents in those neighborhoods, they're going to feel that they solved the problem, at least for themselves, on their own, and they're not going to have the same sense of urgency to get something done with some tangible action like the rest of the city residents are going to feel. And what do the politicians and the bureaucracy that created these crime problems think? Well, Mayor Lightfoot in Chicago, She is skeptical of the private security force. She says the Chicago Police Department has exclusive responsibility for patrolling streets in the Windy City. Yes, it does. She's correct. And that might be the root problem, at least when you consider who controls the Chicago Police Department. I just mentioned Mayor Lightfoot of Chicago. That is the next connection that I want to make, because I have to point out that Mayor Lightfoot, who again is skeptical of that private security force for the special neighborhoods in the city, it's the same mayor who sports and established, she set up herself, a 71-member personal security squad. I don't know if you call a 71-member group a squad, maybe a more apt description is a regiment. And by the way, that's on top of a pre-existing 21-member bodyguard unit. Great illustration of rules for thee, but not for me. In many of those rich Chicago enclaves, they've got residents who own and drive Teslas. And John Kerry, the climate czar, he touts electric vehicles. And the stock market bubble inflated entities like the Rivians that I mentioned and others who make electric vehicles, which all lead to the next dot. And that is how the price of a Tesla compares to the company's original mission. This is a really interesting point. It's something I wanted to discuss for a while, and I'm glad I'm finally able to do so here on the Far Middle. The original mission of Tesla, as laid out by Elon Musk, was to make electric vehicles affordable and available to the masses. But today, a Tesla's average selling price is over $52,000, and it's going up because of all these inflationary pressures. And that excludes the indirect cost or hidden adders to price in the form of tax credits and subsidy that's handed to Tesla from taxpayers by government. So you add all this up, a Tesla these days, when you look at its price, it's more like a car version of a Rolex than it is of a Timex. And it's not exactly what you would call affordable or owned by Chicagoans beyond the elite in those affluent enclaves of the city. So Tesla's original mission of affordable electric vehicles for the masses, it no longer applies. But the government policies designed to feed into that mission, they march on with billions and trillions of taxpayer dollars behind them. These types of dichotomies between the original mission or purpose and the current reality, they're not special or unique to the world of electric vehicles. Policies and regulations and tax code, they come up with complex machinations using the most altruistic of purposes to grossly enrich the most affluent of individuals and entities. It's the honest graft of Tammany Hall that's been resurrected, Tammany Hall back in New York City days. It's just a modern form of it and in a much bigger sort of a format. Which brings us to our next dot, an example of this at work, and that is the subject of conservation easements. Now, a conservation easement is when the federal government will pay you, through tax deductions, a handsome subsidy to have your promise to not use the property that you own for development purposes ever. And development can be timbering, it can be mining, quarrying, or building on it. You basically neuter future use of the land in exchange for tax deductions. It can be very lucrative, especially for rich owners with lots of taxable income and high tax rates. And the advertised intent and purpose is to preserve nature and the environment. Well, the reality is something different. Investors are piling millions of dollars into syndicated funds. You go buy land with no development on the cheap, and then you justify some kind of development on it to then jack up the conceptual value and thus generate millions in tax deductions when the syndicate owners place the conservation easement on the property. So that's sort of how the scheme works. And in places like Northeast Georgia, this is occurring on a large scale for normal surface property where the syndicate is arguing that quarry mining for granite could occur, and that would be worth millions of dollars. Oglethorpe County is the most extreme example of this in Georgia. Just to put this in perspective, the entire county residents, if you add up all the county residents and all of their adjusted gross income in 2019, it was about $314 million. These syndicates for conservation easements in the county alone generated over $500 million in federal tax deductions. So the syndicated conservation easements and what they generate with federal tax deductions, it grossly exceeds the cumulative adjusted gross income of all the residents of Oglethorpe County. Now, saving the planet from something like granite mining that will never happen is an odd way or juxtaposition of issues to come together on. And transferring wealth to the 1% through tax deductions that exceed the cumulative adjusted gross income of the residents in the county where the sham is occurring, is another sort of strange thing to see. In real estate and housing, guess what? They got more expensive and scarcer in that county because land development now is being diminished because of these conservation easements. So doing well by doing good, saving the planet, that's not exactly appropriate taglines for what's occurring in Oglethorpe County when it comes to syndicated conservation easements. Now, speaking of the planet and the state of it, let's talk about either the number two or the actual leader, depending on how you view this, of the free world. And here I'm talking about Vice President Kamala Harris. A few of you ping me from time to time asking why I don't talk more about the vice president and her statements or her actions. Well, maybe because focusing on our vice president in those arenas would consume strings of episodes of the far middle. But let me give you one quick example or dot. At the end of last year, maybe it was at the very start of this year, but I think it was at the end of last year, well before Russia invaded the Ukraine, our Vice President Harris, did an interview on Face the Nation. And the reporter asked her a question that every leader is asked from time to time. What worries you and keeps you up at night? So everybody gets that question that's in a leadership position. Could be a business, could be politics, could be whatever. Okay, so it's not the first time that certainly she heard that question. So did she answer China? No, it's not China that was front of and center of her stress. Was it Russia? Nope. Iranian nukes? Uh-uh. Crime, inflation, opioids? No way. Her answer consisted of two things, climate change and U.S. democracy. And specifically, I think she was referencing the ballot laws across a number of states that were being considered at the time. So you hear that or read that, you just can't take it seriously. And 2022, so far, has not aged those views or that position well at all. Now, I mentioned opioids on that list when I went through China and Russia and Iranian nukes, etc. And I want to focus on opioids to connect the next dot on. Since 2000, 1 million, yes, 1 million Americans have been killed by drug overdoses. A million Americans since 2000, 22 years. In 2021, we set a record as a nation at over 100,000 of our fellow citizens dying from drug overdoses. Yet when you look at that whole of government, what is it focused on? It's focused on things like the code red of CO2 in 50 years in the atmosphere, not this current catastrophe. And that's not to say that I'm a climate skeptic or that climate change doesn't require thought and actions. But again, if you look at the here and now and the tangible and the magnitude of these things, a million Americans dead in 22 years, that has to get your attention as a crisis that needs immediate focus and action from government. To not do so is, frankly, ineptitude bordering on the criminal. Now, speaking of our number two leader, the Vice President Harris, and major powers, I was seeing recently how the number two in China is taking more of an active role to maybe challenge Xi's leadership. So I want to go to the next dot, talk a little bit about how China and its leader Xi is shifting gears as they and he face economic headwinds. I think it's pretty interesting. The signature program of Xi's was known as Common Prosperity. And Common Prosperity was an idea or concept whereby China would look to address economic inequality by redistributing from the better off or the elite to the poorer. So it's not a shock, right? Since this is, after all, China, the communist nation of all communist nations. Class warfare and wealth redistribution, they were perfected by the Chinese Communist Party. In 2021, common prosperity, that hashtag term was everywhere you looked in China. It was mentioned in media speeches, resolutions, it was taught in schools. But then in 2022, strange thing happened. It's disappeared. A 17,000-word economic work report from the government mentioned it one time out of 17,000 words. Now, why did this sort of shift happen? Because the economy in China is staggering, and Xi needs to jolt it awake to stop it from stalling. So the focus is now on economic growth, not on wealth redistribution. The people he was looking to appropriate wealth from, he now needs to drive progress and growth. So regulations are being loosened, development is being encouraged, manufacturing and domestic energy production are being enabled to perform. Now, what's funny, no, actually, it's not funny. What's infuriating, frankly, is how opposite this is from what the U.S. leadership is doing at the same time. our economy is also teetering, right? And the original machinations and rhetoric of the administration sounded a lot like China's common prosperity. But with all the struggle currently in the U.S. economy, the last thing this leadership will do is wake up to the reality and shift gears to embrace the value creators. No, our team sticks to its failed guns that wreak economic destruction, while the opposition's leaders in China, they adjust to the approach that sounds more logical. Strange days when the supposedly free market entity and nation feels more collectivist, more redistributive, and more stuck in the mud than the communist entity or nation. All right, I'm looking at the clock, and unfortunately, it's time to conclude our lightning round episode with a tie back to where we started this. So we started with Don Drysdale, the Dodger great. His uniform number, of course, was 53. That's why we dedicated this episode 53 to him. A big fan of Drysdale's was a Hollywood producer back in the day. His name was Bill Walsh. No, it was not the football coach from the 49ers. But the Hollywood producer, Bill Walsh, he made a movie that kids in the late 60s and all of the 1970s grew to love. I loved it as a little kid. It was Herbie the Love Bug. A lot of you know the concept in the movie. And this was the movie, of course, about the lovable Volkswagen Beetle that was a race car. And if you ever watch the movie and you follow it, or it's follow-on efforts, so if you saw some of the subsequent movies and specials that sort of pivoted off the original, you might recall that Herbie, the love bug, the beetle, always sported a number on its hood. The number, if you can remember, it was 53. Why was Herbie's trademark 53 racing number chosen? That producer, Bill Walsh, was a huge fan of the Los Angeles Dodgers. And who was his favorite player? It was none other than Don Drysdale. All true, look it up. Till next time, over and out.